and a very dangerous criminal or something else. Gottfried Keller, the great German poet of the 19th century, wrote in his old age a poem where he meets a man in the night in the street and recognizes him, a very suspicious man, a criminal of the dirty sort. And he describes in this poem, and then I recognized him. It could have been me. It could have been me. Haven't we both been the geniuses of our class who knew all the answers? The artist is the one who knows all the answers beforehand. Because to him, all things seem to speak immediately. And he believes them. He is foolish enough to believe them. That makes his greatness. He does not distinguish between question and answer because the answer seems always to come before the question. The question has been there, but it was never formulated, the question, because the answer was already there. And what an exciting answer. An answer so exciting that it overruled every possibility of reasonable thinking. Why should one think about such a thing if it is that beautiful, if it has so much meaning, if it is so much nicer, more beautiful, and in a way more significant than reality really is? Transcending given reality into artistic reality at once. Having the answer, so to speak, before, but the question has been there, it just has not been formulated. The process, the inner process of artistic creation, is the only one that can give us a key in order to open up the understanding of mythical thinking, because they both are related. We will later see that and describe and analyze the process, how in Homer's art, out of the very myth, the thing turns around, and suddenly, myth up to then having used art, art started to use myth, and with that the free artist was born. But they are so related in their thinking performances, perceiving performances, that an insight into the artistic creative process can give us more insight into the mythical process. In myth, human beings take everything for granted, but they take it really for granted. I would say that the performance of myth, namely the building up of an entirely fictional, or a world entirely of fancy, of imagination. Fancy, I call it, because it is taken to be reality. Art is not to be taken reality. I mean, no artist would claim today that a picture of Mount Saint-Victoire of Cézanne is Saint-Victoire. It isn't. This thing stands in the Provence. But the musical mind would believe it is. It would take it for reality itself. That is a dream, so-called dream world of the musical mind. It works out of the same thing that the artist's thinking works, the genuine and born artist's thinking, namely out of a tremendous capability for fear. The artist's gift is his blessing, is his curse, namely already as a child to be more fearful, to be more afraid of things themselves, having to transform them immediately into another thing. This magical performance that still sticks to art, only personally, not to the work of art, but to the psychology of the artist, who is driven by this fear, by this original fear of things, to transform them, to give them faces or an appearance, that is more, that is not so frightening, that is more near to human experience, that can be taken for granted. This psychological indication of the artistic process in the artist himself is still another clue to the working of the musical mind. There's only one world in which being and meaning are identical, and that is the world of art. In a work of art, being and meaning, we have those endless discussions about form and content in the work of art, and that goes on in aesthetical science for centuries already. They never come to any results, they can't, because they try to split something up that cannot be split. The terms are not good, content and form. The real terms are meaning and being. What this thing is, this work of art, cannot be distinguished from its meaning, because it is nothing else but its meaning. This has been brought into being by a human capability of artistic creation. This thing, the work of art, exists only for the sake of meaning, for nothing else. It owes its being, its very being, to meaning itself and to nothing else. That makes it an unbreakable unity of being and meaning. This reality, artistic reality, is the only, which is an imaginary reality, of course, only in imagination they are. This is the only real, in another kind of reality, namely artistic, the only really existing unity of being and meaning. Before all that happened, we tried in the beginning to identify being and meaning in the musical way also, namely as a reality of life. Being was supposed to be identical with meaning. Being itself was meaning. Everything as it was had its meaning. This meaning was superimposed. Also as a work of art, so to speak, if we look, assemble, for instance, in the richest development of myths we know, namely the development of Indian myths, an almost unbroken development for 4,000, 6,000 years now. There was once a break, we will consider this break, it was Buddha. But he himself, after he was dead, was already retransformed into this world of myths, with a new kind of musical religion, and finally, when he could not really be fitted in, was thrown out of India altogether, because there is no real Buddhism in India today. Buddhism has been victorious all over Asia, except in India. And again, the development of mythical thinking, dreaming, mythical philosophizing, mythically art building of art, went on and on in India. If we have any knowledge of this tremendous welter of myths, mythical imagination that this development produced, then we have before us one of the greatest miracles of human creativeness. And we find that it contains almost everything. We find, my God, here in Vedanta philosophy seems absolutely abstract, or in the Upanishads already, those abstract formulations, my God, we Europeans, we are so proud that we had developed those things, those people can really think abstract. And then we see, finally, it is not true. Even the capability of so-called abstract thinking here is sheer imagination. It's still mythical thinking. That is the most developed myth we have. On this we have to take into consideration, because here we can learn what we are after, how the mythical mind works. This whole welter has a tremendous artistic quality because it is imagination. It is absolutely unbelievable how deep certain artistic thoughts, let's call them now artistic, really they are musical, of Indian religion, art, and philosophy are. We can reinterpret them again and again and again, and they always seem to reveal a new meaning. But we can do the same thing with great works of art. If we read Shakespeare's play when we are 14 and we interpret them, and others interpret them differently, and when we are 30 we interpret them again and we see there's much more in it, and when we will be 90 and die and make our last interpretation, we will have to discover that they were still deeper. Because they are full of significance, so is myth. It is full of significance. But art is not magic, or it is, so to speak, white magic, if it is magic. It is a magic that only applies to the human mind and helps the human mind to assemble and develop its own imagination and to live richer, to have more experience. But the myth does the opposite. It prevents human beings from having experience. It replaces every experience that a human being as an individual or a person might have by so many artificial, wonderful, artistically expressed experiences of the world that you never have time even to develop an experience of your own. And by this means, the experiences of whole societies have been absolutely equal. They have been equalized in an artificial manner. That made the myth rule the mind. Rule the mind absolutely. Bring the mind into certain patterns which could never change. When you talk with an Indian today, who is still in, an Indian who is still in the myth and hasn't had any Western breakups of those things, you will argue for hours with him about truth, for instance, till you find out that he means something absolutely different from what we mean, because he has an established pattern for truth that runs through thousands of years, and there is no experience for him possible that would contradict this, his concept of truth. He cannot make the experience, or this concept has first to be broken, and his mind has to be by enforced experience brought out of this pattern. Myth is the greatest power the human mind ever invented in order to rule the human mind. A power that was in rule for thousands of years and created those great developments and those great closed empires. An absolute closed system of thought, but infinite. Namely, it can develop that way, but it still remains closed. It is always closed. It is never a personal experience really possible. How hard it must have been, being still in the tradition of the myth, for a man like Buddha to do more than to come out of his castle and see for the first time people dying, as the legend tells us. Must have been much harder for him to come out of this inner castle of mystical thinking, which always would not have allowed him to have one single original thought, a thought of his own, but only developing thoughts that have been given, remaining in the same framework of ideas. In that way, the mystical mind works as an overall picture first. We have to find how it comes about, how the mystical world is nevertheless a world which prepares the jump into freedom. Because if it hadn't, the jump would have been impossible. There's a new system invented, which I almost am always tempted to call pseudo-mythical. And those are the modern totalitarian ideologies. A system that with all its might tries to rule the human mind absolutely again. And many people today think, whatever they might do, there will still be the possibility later of the development of the human mind back into freedom. I doubt it. because this seems to be a system where certain features that the myth had and which prepared the possibility of freedom, they are not visible in those new features, in those new systems, those features. We have to look into the question, what are those features? So let's say the human mind, to give a figure, is so to speak in the womb, in the mythical world, in the womb of the all of being. It is unable to take real conscious position towards being. It is entirely contained in being. It merely reflects being. Its first taking position is merely reflective and creative only as far as a dream world is creative, which should be and is supposed to be the real world, as the world really is. We can best make that clear to ourselves, as we would say this is a paradox, that if somebody would go, and he would today be an insane person, somebody would go around and say that the real world is a world of art. And all what he sees around him and what we are doing in our daily life and thinking and so just does not count. Because the real world is a world of art. Everything else is illusion. So everything real in the mythical world, as we would call real, is illusion. And everything fictional is real in the mythical world. And that is the secret of the practice of magic. That is the practice of the myth in the mythical world. We will have to look into that too in order to understand how the break could be made and how the human mind could come out of this first womb, which is, so to speak, the womb of the all-mother, which is called all-being. No. Why you want to take this course? I almost don't know why I want to give it. The reasons why, the different reasons why you are here and want to take the course might come out by and by in the first hour of this course that we usually will use for discussion, the second hour of this third lecture on topic. Those reasons might, I hope, be very relevant to the purpose of the course, namely the reasons everybody of you singularly has come for. They will be very relevant if we all could find out that we have one reason in common to take this course, namely the reason why I think I should give this course. I hope you came here because you are troubled. Because I came here, because I am troubled. Deeply troubled. This program has been written in order to provide for a hook that should bring in people who at least are troubled somehow, and to keep out the busybodies, namely those who are not troubled in the least because they have the answers all the time. I cannot give any answers in this course, I'm certainly not here to give answers. If people come because they are troubled, then they should be people who know first that ready-made answers are not possible, and second, who would never be ready to accept any ready-made answers. And that would mean that they have already the philosophic attitude, that they come with the philosophic attitude. The happy times when philosophers could say that what induced them to do philosophy, to philosophize, that this was wonderment, astonishment, is a word. Aristotle says that, a lucky man and a lucky situation of philosophy. Philosophers today must confess, if really asked sufficiently, that mostly they have been driven to philosophize because they were so troubled. Troubled about ourselves. Well, people who are troubled about themselves go to the psychoanalyst. There they find out that the ready-made answers don't answer much. But they might get help for certain problems. And if they really are only troubled about themselves, it might be easy. But being fundamentally troubled means to have realized that oneself, one's friends, the society one lives on in, the world altogether seems to have lost sense of direction, that nothing makes really sense anymore, that the question why all that can somehow not be answered so readily anymore as could before for former generations. They might have had illusions and we might be free of illusions, but the story stayed up here. There hasn't been a time in mankind's history, I think, where people didn't think they were in a crisis. The old times were always the fine and good times, and the time one lived in was always a bad one, and a decidedly a time of crisis. We think so too. The question is, have we better reason to think so? Might be so. Have the answers been? The answers have been always two sets of answers. And they relate to what Schopenhauer called the basic qualities of man, dumbness and laziness. The answers have been two categories. The one, there's great hope because of progress today. The other, there's great danger. We have our theories of doom today. About all the answers we get today, as well as one got in the time of the Romans, of the Greeks, of in every crisis, are those two categories. They have something in common. They relate to those qualities. They seem to show that man is not made for thinking. That he tries one thing most in his life, to avoid thinking. Because there's no difference between despair and hope. Both serve the same purpose. Man is a funny kind of animated being. We will have to ask and find out if he is really free or can be free. One thing is sure, he's arbitrary. He's a fantastic being. And if he starts to believe in religions or theories or ideologies of doom, the world will go to pieces in this century or the next year. That gives him a great joy. He pleases himself very much with theories like that. A great critic of languages, a German named Fritz Mauthner, has once asked the question to the pessimists. You always say life is short and very spoiled and rotten. Now I ask you one question, rotten and then too short. There's pleasure in pessimism, and there is pleasure in optimism. They give the great satisfaction first, silently, that one does not have anything really to do about anything. Because what is going to happen is going to happen anyway. If it is doom, well, being a fantastic being first, man has the unfortunate quality to enjoy suffering. There is no animal and no being in the world except man who can manage to do that, enjoy suffering. It takes mostly the form, of course, a precautious form, that men then enjoy in the first line the suffering of others. That means makes them suffer, the source of cruelty, a capability of man that distinguishes him from every other being alive, the possibility to be cruel, to make suffer, to invent pain, to inflict pain. But we have seen very often too that those must not be cowards. We have examples that the worst torturers of our time, Nazis and Bolsheviks, produced types who, when their turn came to suffer, enjoyed that too, in a way. They all have one thing in common. They never had anything really to do about things. They only were executing things that had to happen anyway. That way they became executioners even. Enjoyed it. And some of them enjoyed even being executed. Man is a strange being. So, from a philosophical point of view, we distrust the prophets of doom as we distrust the prophets of progress. Optimism and pessimism are feelings, self-enjoyments, and they have the great thing in common that one does not need to think and to do, which is the same. Our time, or better, our situation, seems to be especially a troublesome. Everybody will be able to account for that. The question is there a special reason for that? First, it is certainly the biggest trouble mankind ever run into. Why is it the biggest? For the simple reason that there never have been such masses of people involved. Makes things more complicated every day and more terrible. But is it also perhaps the greatest time of trouble we know of? If it should be a great time, but the greatest time of trouble, then it would mean that it must have a significance for mankind